What if the greatest economic revolution wasn't the internet or industrialization, but the moment our ancestors planted a seed instead of searching for one? Around 10,000 years ago, agriculture transformed everything. Suddenly, people could produce more food than they immediately needed. That surplus became the foundation for cities, writing, and eventually economic thought itself. In ancient Mesopotamia, the earliest writing systems emerged not for poetry or history, but to track who owned what, the first balance sheets carved in clay. The Greeks took this further. Plato imagined a perfect society where philosopher kings ruled and commerce was minimized, fearing that wealth pursuit would corrupt the soul. His student, Aristotle, disagreed, noting that people take better care of what they personally own, an insight that would echo through centuries. He distinguished between natural exchange, selling your surplus, and unnatural profit-seeking, condemning money-lending as the worst economic sin. Money-breeding money, he argued, violated the natural order. Yet despite philosophical warnings, trade flourished across Alexander's empire and Roman territories. When Rome fell, economic thinking found an unlikely home, Christian monasteries, where monks would wrestle with questions of fairness, profit, and God's will in commerce. Medieval Europe faced a profound tension. How could Christians engage in commerce without losing their souls? The Bible portrayed work as punishment for original sin, and Jesus warned that pursuing wealth could lead people away from God. Thomas Aquinas, the era's most influential thinker, developed the concept of the just price, not the highest amount a desperate buyer would pay, but what was normally charged without deception. This wasn't naive idealism, but practical ethics for functioning markets. Aquinas condemned usury with theological precision. Money was barren and couldn't reproduce like livestock or crops. When you lend $100 and demand $110 back, where does that extra $10 come from? To medieval thinkers, it represented an unnatural extraction from the borrower's labor. But as Venice and Florence flourished through international trade, reality pressed against doctrine. Merchants stored coins with money changers, who facilitated transfers and provided loans, becoming the first bankers. Insurance emerged to manage shipping risks. The church gradually softened its stance, recognizing that reasonable interest rates were necessary for banking to function. By the late medieval period, merchants increasingly believed they could serve both God and profit. This wasn't abandoning morality, but adapting it to economic complexity, a shift that would open the door to modern capitalism while maintaining ethical constraints on ruthless behavior. In 1776, Adam Smith posed a revolutionary question: is self-interest compatible with a good society? His answer challenged convention. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, Smith wrote, but from their regard to their own interest. This wasn't celebrating greed. It recognized that when people honestly pursue their own goals, they naturally create value for others through exchange. Smith called this the invisible hand, the remarkable way individual self-interest, when channeled through markets, promotes social harmony without central planning. David Ricardo extended these insights while addressing Britain's industrial growing pains. As a wealthy stockbroker turned economist, he opposed the corn laws that enriched landlords while impoverishing workers. His most enduring contribution was comparative advantage, showing how countries benefit from trade even when one is better at producing everything. Just as friends divide chores based on relative efficiency, countries should specialize in what they produce relatively best, then trade. This principle became economics' most cherished idea, suggesting all nations gain through open borders and specialization. Victor Hugo's Fantine embodied countless victims of industrial capitalism, crushed not by laziness, but by a cruel economic system. Despite unprecedented wealth, children labored in factories, disease ravaged crowded cities, and workhouses brutalized the poor. People question whether poverty was truly a personal failing. Charles Fourier imagined communal phalansteries where people pursued their passions. Robert Owen built model communities, believing good environments create good people. Thomas Malthus offered grimmer analysis. Population grows geometrically, while food increases arithmetically, ensuring perpetual poverty checked only by famine, disease, or contraception, earning economics its dismal science nickname. Marx rejected both utopian idealism and Malthusian pessimism. He argued capitalism's internal contradictions, workers creating wealth they cannot afford, would trigger inevitable revolution. He identified alienation as workers' disconnection from their labor, reduced to machine appendages with no connection to final products. This dark period revealed markets alone couldn't guarantee human flourishing. Arthur Cecil Pigou revealed how markets fail when actions create externalities, costs or benefits affecting third parties. Factory pollution poisoning rivers or a neighbor's loud trumpet create gaps between private and social costs, producing too much harm and too little benefit. Pigou advocated targeted intervention, taxes on negative externalities, subsidies for positive ones, and direct provision of public goods like street lighting. Thorsten Veblen, America's most unconventional economist, dissected Gilded Age excess with an outsider's clarity. He showed how industrialization spawned a leisure class flaunting wealth through conspicuous consumption, impractical possessions and leisure activities proving they didn't need to work. Women's restrictive clothing signaled exemption from manual labor. This status-seeking cascaded through all classes, creating a wasteful treadmill of dissatisfaction strikingly familiar in today's Instagram age. Together, Pigou and Veblen demonstrated that markets don't automatically serve society's interests and human behavior isn't purely rational. By 1933, America's collapse left 13 million unemployed, a quarter of all workers. Homeless families built shacks while desperate job seekers rode freight trains searching for work. John Maynard Keynes argued conventional economics couldn't explain this crisis. Traditional theory assumed economies always operated at full capacity. To make more boots meant fewer hats. But Keynes saw a different reality. America's industrial production had halved while millions sat idle. The problem wasn't scarcity, but a broken connection between supply and demand. Keynes illustrated the economy as a bathtub, where spending is the water level. Conventional Say's Law assumed savings always returned as investment. But Keynes argued savings might disappear under mattresses. When businesses stop investing, spending drops, factories produce less, workers get sacked, and recession follows. Unlike conventional economists who believed in self-correction, Keynes saw economies could get stuck in depression. His revolutionary insight, government intervention was necessary to rescue capitalism from itself. By increasing spending during downturns, governments could restart the economic engine, transforming economics into macroeconomics and microeconomics. Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky pioneered behavioral economics by revealing how mental fog distorts our decisions. Their research uncovered loss aversion. We feel losses more intensely than equivalent gains. Richard Thaler's experiment showed people who received a mug valued it far higher than those asked to buy it, because we judge outcomes relative to our starting point. Framing profoundly affects choices. Identical health programs presented as either saving 200 people or 400 people dying produced opposite preferences despite identical outcomes. Robert Shiller applied these insights to explain the 1990s tech bubble, where investors behaved like a fashion-driven herd. When it burst in 2000, $2 trillion vanished within a week. Shiller noted this pattern resembled historical manias like the Dutch tulip bubble and correctly predicted the subsequent housing crash. These insights challenged economic orthodoxy by revealing markets aren't always efficient and people aren't always rational. Understanding our irrational tendencies helps design better policies that account for actual human behavior. Economics solves real problems beyond abstract theory. Alvin Roth revolutionized organ transplantation by creating a kidney exchange system matching incompatible patient-donor pairs, facilitating thousands of life-saving transplants without introducing money into sensitive domains. William Nordhaus addressed global warming's double externality, carbon emissions affecting the entire planet and future generations. Carbon taxes or trading permits allow those who can reduce emissions cheaply to make larger cuts, achieving environmental goals more efficiently than uniform mandates. Amartya Sen developed the capabilities approach, focusing not on income alone, but on people's abilities to function, being nourished, healthy, safe, and participating in community life. He showed starvation occurs not from food shortages, but from entitlement collapse, when people can't access available food due to unemployment or price spikes. Democracy and press freedom prove crucial because governments become accountable when journalists report suffering. Economics isn't mathematics with permanently right answers. We face new challenges: extreme inequality, financial crises, climate change. Getting solutions right means more people live good lives. Getting them wrong means suffering. Economics must return to essential questions. What makes a good society? What do people need for happiness and fulfillment?